What I'd like to speak about this evening is compassion. And I'd like to begin with kind of evoking compassion. In Tibetan Buddhism, Avalokiteshvara is said to be the personification of compassion. So I just want to begin with a little bit of a reading. We evoke your name, Avalokiteshvara. We aspire to learn your way of listening in order to help relieve the suffering in this world. You know how to listen in order to understand. We evoke your name in order to practice listening with all our attention and open-heartedness. We will sit and listen without any prejudice. We will sit and listen without judging or reacting. We will sit and listen in order to understand. We will sit and listen so attentively that we will be able to hear what is being said as well as what is being left unsaid. For we know that just by listening deeply, we already alleviate a great deal of pain and suffering. In modern times, one of the beings that I think of as being a living personification of compassion is someone named Mahagosananda. He's a Cambodian teacher who died just this past March. I was actually out here teaching when he died. And in one of the local newspapers around here, the headline was "A Legacy of Compassion." There was a whole kind of story about him and about what he did in, with his life in this area. And so the headline was "A Legacy of Compassion." Mahagosananda had a title. He was the Grand Patriarch of Cambodia. And he actually had little business cards that said, "Grand Patriarch of Cambodia," that he would pass out when he met you. He was somebody that traveled around this whole world most of the time by himself. And at one point, Michael and I bumped into him in the Tokyo airport. We were really just there for a short amount of time. I can't remember whether it was en route to that trip to Nepal I told you about or not. But we were there for just a couple of hours, and we saw Mahagosananda, and it was such a delight to see an old and dear friend. And he was with somebody, a young man was attending to him. And then it's kind of like, because we recognized him and knew him, this young man passed him on to us to take care of for the time that he was in the airport. And that's really how he got around the world, is being passed on from one friend to another. At one point, because he was in ill health and he was fragile and he was up there in years, some of his devotees wanted him to travel around with people and not be by himself all the time. And his response was, "Oh, no, 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 I don't need any attendants. My attendants are wisdom and compassion." You know? And, of course, implied was that wisdom and compassion were what were keeping him safe. Mahagosananda was not in Cambodia during the Khmer Rouge regime, but during that time that he was away, most of his family and most of his friends were killed. He was one of the first Buddhist monks to return to Cambodia after the regime collapsed. And one thing he did, he tried to bring people together, and one thing he did was to lead peace marches across Cambodia. And as many of us know, this was a very dangerous thing to do because bombs could go off at any moment. He refused to see the Khmer Rouge simply as the enemy, but he really devoted a lot of his life to working towards the reintegration and harmony between them and the rest of Cambodian society. And I wanted just to read you something about him. Mahagosananda opened a Buddhist temple in a barren refugee camp of the Khmer Rouge communists. There were 50,000 villagers who had become communists at gunpoint and had now fled the destruction to camps on the Thai border. In this camp, the underground Khmer Rouge camp leaders threatened to kill anyone who went to the temple. Yet, on its opening day, more than 20,000 people crowded into the dusty square for the ceremony. These were the sad remnants of families, an uncle with two nieces, a mother with only one of three children. The schools had been burned, the villages destroyed, and in nearly every family, members had been killed or ripped away. I wondered what he could say to people who had suffered so greatly. Mahagosananda began the service with the traditional chants that had permeated village life for 1,000 years. Though these words had been silenced for 8 years of war and the temples destroyed, they still remained in the hearts of these people whose lives had known as much sorrow and injustice as any on earth. Then Mahagosananda began teaching one of the central verses of the Buddha, first in Pali and then in Cambodian, reciting the words over and over again. Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is an ancient and eternal law. Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is an ancient and eternal law. As he chanted these verses over and over, thousands began to chant with him. They chanted and wept. It was an amazing moment, for it was clear that their hearts longed for this forgiveness like a parched desert. And it was clear that the presence of this monk and the truth that he chanted was even greater than the sorrows they had to bear. Although he did these remarkable kinds of things in his country of origination, he also was somebody who touched so many people in so many kind of remarkably ordinary ways. And maybe even somebody here, or more than one of you, have your own story about Mahagosananda. I know when I spoke about him in March, one person came up to me and had a story to share. My story about him is that when I was a very young teacher, about maybe 20 years ago, 22 years ago, that kind of time, I was teaching at CIMC then, the Cambridge Insight Meditation Center, and I started a group for beginners, and it was a drop-in style group, so people would just drop in. They would drop in, and we would meet down in the basement of CIMC. And those who have, you who have been to the center, and many of you here somewhat live at the center, I have to say. When you leave this retreat, it's just like going home to the center. You know, it's a really nice room at this point. And if you started going to the center in the year 2000, you never would have known it as anything different. But before the year 2000, when the center was renovated, this basement was a very strange place to be. It had a rug that was a normal rug on the bottom of the floor, but then it looked like it was growing up the walls. So it went like, you know, at least a quarter of the way up the walls. It seemed like it was even more than that. And then kind of, you know, over this sort of lip kind of thing. So it was kind of like, you know, Night of the Living Rug kind of situation. I used to feel like that down there. So anyway, I was just down there in this room, and there were a number of people down there. I don't know, not a big group, maybe 10 to 15 people. And we're doing our thing, and I'm giving the instructions and, you know, doing the best I can. And all of a sudden, this person starts coming down the stairs. And he is a monk, you know, he's a Buddhist monk. But any of you who knew Mahakosananda or saw him in person, you would know that he used to wear his robes in quite interestingly eccentric ways. Yeah, they kind of were always haphazard or falling off of him or, you know, this kind of thing. So he was just adorable. So he, this person came down and I recognized him as Mahakosananda. I had met him before. And he just came down and he plopped himself on the floor. And this is really an unusual thing with a young woman. Actually, it doesn't have to be young, with a woman of any kind, to just come down and plop yourself on the floor like that is not usually the style of Buddhist monks. So that was quite an unusual and remarkable and lovely thing that he just sat down. And then he began being part of the class. I mean, he closed his eyes, he meditated. And then afterwards, we had our usual question and answer time when people could ask questions. And people were a little intimidated by his presence. I mean, this was so far out from their usual experience in Cambridge that they didn't really know what to do. So people were a little bit shy instead of asking questions the way they usually did. But, you know, there were some questions. And then he decided, I guess, to ask a question. And the remarkable thing about it, I mean, it was just a question about the breath, a simple question about the breath. But I genuinely felt that he really wanted to hear my answer. You know, he knows the answer. He had probably said the same teaching just, you know, countless times to other people. But there was that kind of freshness where he wasn't testing me. You know, he wasn't doing that kind of a thing. He was actually genuinely interested in my answer. At least this is the way he made me feel, which was a really beautiful thing. So I felt it to be so kind on his part and so supportive and just such a beautiful encounter. I'd like to define compassion. And just to say a word or two about the difference between metta and compassion. Metta is, as you know, a sense of friendliness and warmth, you know, that really can spread over all beings. And compassion is more specifically oriented towards pain, towards the alleviation of pain. So in a way, it's the same thing. Both are great. But compassion has a little bit of a different taste to it because of the specific targeting of pain and suffering. The Pali word for compassion is karuna. And what karuna means, or the translation of karuna, is the trembling of the heart in response to suffering. So this trembling means being moved by sorrow, being moved by suffering, being willing to feel. You know, instead of sometimes that frozenness, the frozenness of the heart, trembling of the heart, to be in contact with suffering. It also means caring for and holding suffering gently until it changes on its own. To break this definition down, the trembling of the heart in response to suffering, one word that's really crucial in this definition is the word response. In response to suffering, rather than in reactivity to pain and suffering. So response means that first we need to open to it. We need to be aware of pain, of suffering. We don't want to deny or pretend it's not happening or push it away. So the first thing that's necessary is a simple recognition, suffering is happening right now. Just to simply know, the word in Pali is dukkha, that suffering is occurring, unsatisfactoriness is happening, pain is occurring right now. So we want to recognize it, because if we don't recognize it, then nothing is possible. And then, and this is equally important, there is a reorientation that has to take place. And this reorientation is away from our conditioned ways of thinking, which means away from our good-bad dualistic way of thinking. And instead, is there suffering or is there not? This is really the next step here. Instead of good, bad, right, wrong, ugly, beautiful, is there suffering or is there not? So we want to be aware of our relationship to suffering, because that's the only way that our relationship to suffering can change and compassion can be the natural organic response instead of the reactivity that our conditioning leads us into. I told you about one of my nieces the other night, and I actually have four nieces, and I want to say I have four in case they ever grow up and learn the Dharma and want to listen to a Dharma talk. I don't want to leave any of them out. Four nieces, four beautiful nieces. Two of them I want to just say a little bit about in relationship to a very big situation in my life. My mother died in the year 2004, and she had quite a beautiful death. My sister and I were with her as she died, and my father and my other sister were there a great deal of the time before she died. And it was very connected. It was very, very good, very rich, very serene, very beautiful. And because of the work that had been done beforehand, there wasn't a sense of anything left to say or anything that needed to be done, really just the simple accompaniment of her as far as we could take her. But during this time of our knowing she was about to die, but her being in a hospital and us all being around her, she was hooked up to different machines, of course, and she had a breathing tube in her, and she looked at certain times really different than she usually looked, you know? And so my nieces, of course, this is their grandmother, and they really adored her, and she looked different than they had been used to seeing her as their very comforting grandmother. And it was so interesting how they related to seeing her in this way. One of them went, and they're both great. They both have their different strengths and beauties. One came in, and she just wasn't afraid at all. She went right up to her, and she took her by the hand. And the way my mother looked just did not faze her. She went right up to her and started just chatting. You know, hi, Grammy. You know, my mother, of course, couldn't talk. But, you know, hi, Grammy, how you doing? What's up? You know, but just really connected, really so beautiful. And the other one hung back, you know, really loved her Grammy in the same way. But she couldn't come in the room. She was just kind of hanging around, you know, by the edges of the room, not really quite sure of how far she wanted to enter in. So just really different approaches. You know, when my mother actually did die, the one who had been hanging back burst into tears. And just recently with a family event that had nothing to do with anything but a joyful experience, celebration, she broke into tears just recently because of resonating with the fact that my mother couldn't be there. You know, so she felt it deeply. They both felt it deeply. But they were with it in different ways, you know, because this is how we are. We are with suffering in different ways. I know for me, in this time period, I felt very accepting, and I knew that my mother's time was up and that everything was complete and it was time for her to go. And I felt quite okay Certainly a lot of different feelings, but quite okay. But then there was one point where I was with her by myself. Everyone else had left, and of course I was happy to be with her by myself, and I was just sitting with her, meditating, sending her metta. And all of a sudden, this was about a day before she actually passed away, all of a sudden, I felt this huge resistance. You know, just this huge resistance of, you can't go. You know, you can't leave me. This kind of thing. And because I had been so accepting and I had really, you know, it was such a beautiful experience, it kind of was a little bit of a, it was just a different, you know. I wouldn't quite say surprise, but it was different. And then, you know, I was so happy that actually by the time my mother left, that had changed, that had passed. And so it was a different kind of leave-taking. But, you know, we just don't know what's going to happen when we're in the midst of these huge events. And just to accept whatever way we feel, I think, is quite essential. You know, this resistance, don't go. It was kind of like one of my close friends who was in labor saying, I can't do this. You know? Well, it's a little late, you know? Compassion is the awareness of an inherent connectedness between ourselves and all beings. And I want to read you something. An ordained rabbi had written to Einstein, explaining that he had sought in vain to comfort his 19-year-old daughter over the death of her sister. And this is what Einstein wrote back. A human being, wrote Einstein in reply, is a part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but the striving for such achievement is in itself a part of the liberation and a foundation for inner security. Now, I don't know about saying all this to a 19-year-old. It's a lot. But it's so to the point. I don't know if any of you saw, but those of you who live in the Boston area, but recently in the Globe, a few weeks ago, there was an article about a cat who... Some of you read it, yeah. This cat lives in a hospice and lives in an area of this hospice where people who have dementia are being cared for as they die. And this cat, I guess this cat has done this perhaps 22 or 23 times, something along those lines. So really a number of times, not just a fluke, not just once. This cat knows when one of the people in this ward is about to actually die. And then this cat jumps on the bed and stays with the person until they die. You know, jumps on the bed and starts purring. And so is there to, in a sense, accompany that person. And the people in the hospice so much trust this cat that they know when to call the family in. Because, you know, it's hard, of course, to know when to call family in. But they trust the cat. They actually have a big banner up that says, to our trusted and, you know, wonderful hospice cat who serves so many beings, this kind of thing, that they call the family in when the cat decides to jump up. And the cat kind of, I guess, goes between the wards just sort of patrolling. But really, but doesn't jump on a bed unless it's that time. You know, doesn't like jump up and purr with this person and that person. It's not like that at all. You know, the cat is kind of just alert to when the help is really needed. So, in metta practice, I'm so, for years now, I've been saying with the benefactor, you know, if you don't have a person to send loving kindness to or feel it from, that you should use your pet, you should use your dog or your cat. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, you know, this is really good, definitely. And you need to build up to a human being at some point. But I'm not sure now. You know? I'm not sure. That's kind of gone for me. So we share this sense of fragility with all other bodies. This is our connectedness with one another. The other side of compassion, though, that is equally important is an awareness of true nature, our own and others. You know, in other words, sensing the deathless and understanding that we share the deathless. We share not only our fragility, but we share a radiance with one another as well. So really you could say that true compassion, a real, authentic, complete understanding of compassion, is the merging of sorrow and of joy. Compassion is, as the Buddha said, a pleasant sense of care. Now, the first time I heard this definition, a pleasant sense of care, I had no idea what was meant, because it didn't seem pleasant at all to me. And this is really where we need to learn the difference between responding and reacting. We tend to react in the face of pain, of suffering, of sorrow, our own and others, sometimes by becoming numb, sometimes by getting afraid, or by feeling helpless or paralyzed. Sometimes we feel angry or sad or judgmental. Sometimes the experience is one of being embarrassed or feeling shame because of suffering. And in responsiveness, and this is where the pleasure part comes from, it's a meditative kind of pleasure. In responsiveness, there actually is a sense of confidence. There is a sense of strength. There is a sense of capability. And when we feel confident and strong and capable, there is a real pleasure in that. Compassion is learning how to care. May I care for this pain? May I care for this sorrow? These are some of the compassion phrases. Just as there are metta phrases, there are compassion phrases. And the compassion phrases that I like best are these. May I care for this pain, may I care for this sorrow. Compassion is not guilt or pity, because pity and guilt are reactions. Pity and guilt, with this, there's a sense of separation. Me over here, feeling sorry for poor little you over there. You know, almost anything is better than that when you're the recipient of that. I had a recent just kind of experience of this, because I had a huge bruise on my forehead from an acupuncture treatment gone bad. Generally, this doesn't happen, but he really got the needles in there, and really huge bruises, and I had to be in public. And it was so interesting to walk around in public with this huge bruise on my face, and people reacting just in so many different ways. You know, some people you could really see that there was real concern. Some people just tried to avoid me, you know, which always happens, you know, when somebody looks to be in pain. And some people just looked at me like, poor little you, you know. Which actually was not necessary in that particular situation, and is actually never necessary. There's a book called Hannah's Gift, which was written by a woman whose 5-year-old daughter died of leukemia. And she says this: compassion does not feel sorry in the face of suffering. It knows that all suffering is its own. When we recognize this connection between us and everyone else, we know that we belong to each other. We do not suffer alone. Michael and I have a teacher named Master Sheng Yan, and he wrote this in one of his books. During one retreat, a student came to me in a very emotional state, saying that her compassion had been moved powerfully, that she felt pity for suffering people and wanted to help them. From her point of view, this seemed like a very good experience to have, but I scolded her, and I'll tell you, we know him. He definitely does scold. So I laughed when I saw the word scolded. I thought that was accurate. But I scolded her, saying, "You're just fooling around in sentimentality. This is not wisdom. In the mind of wisdom, there is no such thing as people needing to be pitied. Compassion is not simple sentimentality. It's just a natural response to help people." Compassion as well is not fear. And sometimes we mistake it to be fear. Fear is an inner recoiling. Sometimes when there is this inner recoiling, we outwardly tend to give advice. You know? We're giving advice sometimes as a way to control the situation, the effort to fix, rushing in to fix and control. Sometimes fear is mistaken to be compassion because of our efforts to avoid conflict, our inability to say no, and thinking that always saying yes is compassion. Compassion must be aligned with wisdom. It is not compassion to let others work their torments of heart out on one. It's actually fear. Compassion as well is not anger. And of course, in the midst of certain situations, in the midst of injustice, oftentimes anger is the initial energy. That's just how it is. It doesn't have to be a problem. It's just that we don't want to live there. Sometimes it's the initial energy. And I think of what Eli Wiesel said, that the opposite of love is not hatred, it's indifference. You know, so that initial sense of anger, all right, in certain situations, yeah, it just is there. It's just that the question is one of alignment, and this is so hard when we're trying to understand this in relationship to those that have caused harm, to those that have caused us harm, to those that have caused our loved ones harm, to those that have caused enormous harm in this world. It's not an easy area. But the whole question around anger, you know, again, this initial arising, so be it. But the question really has to be, what do we want to ultimately align our hearts with? You know, it's really a question of alignment. Do we want to align with love? Or do we want to align with bitterness? And I don't think anyone in this world wants to live in resentment and in hurts and in nursing private hurts and sometimes, of course, in pettiness. In looking at this question, whether we want to align with love or with bitterness, this awareness has the potential to cut through the clinging. The clinging that, of course, is going to be there in certain situations. But it allows us to look more deeply, to look at the cost to our hearts.